97.1 FM Talk Podcast. This hour of the Mark Reardon Show is sponsored by Gamma Tree Experts. Your trees deserve the best care. Call Gamma Tree Experts. This is the Mark Reardon Show on 97.1 FM Talk.
And welcome into the show. I'm Ryan Recker filling in today. Mike Elam, I believe, is in tomorrow. And wow, another great show. I mean, we had a great show yesterday. We have a great show again today. I see this news here, and I've seen some other agencies reporting it yesterday, but mostly the pickup today, that Donald Trump won't assign a special prosecutor to the Jeffrey Epstein case. He doesn't want to. I don't know if that's going to change. I don't know if that's going to be something that perhaps could come up in the future, but this is such a, to me, big deal that they're not going to release and disclose this information. The transparency of trying to keep under wraps the information of a prolific child sex trafficker of Jeffrey Epstein, to think that for some reason we have to hold back on this information, it almost guarantees there's something else nefarious going on there when you start to hide these sort of things. And there's so many different high-profile people that look at this and say, if they say they don't have it, they don't have it. You have to move on. You can't dwell on this long-term because you're going to stir up even more conspiracy theories that way, and it's going to hurt the party, and what's that going to look like? So if they say it's not there, it's not there. You have to take them for their word. But I'm thinking to myself, no, you don't have to take the government for their word, even when it's the person that you believe in, even as when the person you agree with or voted for. You don't have to take them for their word just because they say it's not there. If you have someone as prolific as Jeffrey Epstein, who we know was engaging in this activity, and we have other witnesses and victims that have come forward and named people already, and we know that this information was gathered by high-ranking officials, and for the government to say there's no list is ludicrous. It goes against every bit of information we know, because these agencies collect information. It's their job. It's what they do. So to go out and say, no, don't look at the man behind the curtain, doesn't that just make you as a skeptic want to look at what's all behind the curtain? And then when they say, no, you can't do it, you're going to look even harder. And I know there's a lot of other things going on in this country that are very important to reach, but this is an easy thing to do. You can easily say, we're still working on it. We're going to release it. We know that we haven't met the deadline that we said we put it out, but we're going to. It's not what they're saying. What they're saying is there is nothing to release. And that is just beyond my understanding here of how they can get away with saying something like that. So part of the story, it says, the Trump administration's handling of the Jeffrey Epstein case has led to calls for some of his supporters to appoint a special prosecutor, but the president isn't in favor of the idea, the White House official said. And I think we also saw some other people asking about this during the press briefing today. Caroline Leavitt was asked, this is clip number 15. Can we play that? I think it's 15.
Can you clarify which part of the Epstein hoax is the hoax part?
The president is referring to the fact that Democrats have now seized on this as if they ever wanted transparency when it comes to Jeffrey Epstein, which is an asinine suggestion for any Democrat to make. The Democrats had control of this building, the White House, for 4 years, and they didn't do a dang thing when it came to transparency in regards to Jeffrey Epstein and his heinous crimes.
Yeah, well, that's true. I mean, if you think about their level of interest in this has always been kind of muted, quiet, and there's probably a reason for that. I mean, thinking about maybe their biggest surrogate and their biggest, I guess, well, outside of Barack Obama, you also have Bill Clinton and the implications of him and what does that look like. But it's guaranteed he's there. I mean, there's photo evidence and other witnesses that came forward to saying that he was there. But other parts of this is, okay, they always try to rope in Donald Trump into this. He says he doesn't have a connection to it. The part that we do know that has been confirmed is that at one point they knew each other, and then Donald Trump cut him off from Mar-a-Lago. And in fact, he actually went after them because I think Jeffrey Epstein was trying to entangle himself with one of the employees there. So Donald Trump stepped in, and that's when he cut him off. And I think he helped the family after that. So it was actually a good thing that a story that came out with Donald Trump. The thing that I think Democrats pull out at Donald Trump with the Epstein stuff is that witnesses will bring his name up in testimony. So they'll say he is part of the files. But when you go back and you read where he is in the files, I'll give you a couple of examples. They have witnesses that are there for depositions, and the witnesses will say, you know, these are the people we saw, and they start naming, you know, the Al Gore's, and I forgot some of the other people. There's some high profile people you would recognize. And then the person that was leading the deposition, at least the questioning, would say, what about Donald Trump? The person said, no. Are you sure there wasn't Donald Trump? No, there wasn't Donald Trump. You ever heard of rumors of Donald Trump? No, I never heard of rumors of Donald Trump. And they would go and they were trying to bait them. They weren't asking questions about any other person besides him. They were purposely trying to set him up for this. And it seemed like every time there was a witness that came forward, they all said, no, he wasn't there. Another part of this is other testimonies that came back in part of court hearings. You find that Trump's name comes up because Jeffrey Epstein stayed at a Trump hotel, not that because he met with him or did anything else other than he like requested a hotel room or something like that. These are the type of like references that come up in these legal documents that implicate him. None. So I keep thinking to myself, everything that we've seen from this so far, it does not point to him. Why else would he be fearful of releasing this information? Does he think it's his duty as president to protect former presidents or other high profile people, knowing that it would be totally embarrassing and criminal if their name came up? It would ruin their lives. Is it the obligation to other people why this is coming up? And part of this too is Dan Bongino. And The Hill did an article on this and said, Bongino has been at the center of debate over the Epstein files after the Justice Department essentially closed the case in a joint memo with the FBI. The deputy FBI director has clashed with Attorney General Pam Bondi over the issue and reportedly weighed resigning. And part of this, too, when you read the way that this person wrote the article, his name is Brett Samuels, and this one came out today. The outrage over on the right over the prospect of Bongino exiting underscored both his importance to the base and how central he's been to, this is where they use the term, fueling the controversies. And when you hear this term and you find this in a lot of times, these hit pieces that are written by pretty left-leaning liberals to anyone that may be conservative or right-leaning, you find that they start using the same phrasing and the same wording. So they say fueling the controversies, fueling the conspiracies, fueling the conspiracy theories. How many times have you seen or heard that in these type of left-leaning publications over the last couple of weeks? As in, they, as the writer, will believe what the government is telling them, that these files don't exist. Which is interesting, because if you go back, and if they are, in fact, left-leaning, then they are going to default back into what the Biden administration left them with. So they're going to agree with them when it agrees with the Biden administration. They'll agree with Trump when it agrees with Biden. And that's the only instance where they'll say, don't worry, there's no man behind the curtain. I think this is very troubling in a lot of different ways. I don't think this is going to go away. I think a lot of people are going to be upset. I think a lot of people will continue to bring up the issues that are there, and rightfully so. I think it's worthy of continuing to be part of a contention. You know, we got a big show planned for today. We're going to actually talk to a senior director at the Government Affairs for the National Taxpayers Union on the rescissions, and why is it needed? Have they gone far enough? Is this the end of it? Are we going to see more in the future? Because $9 billion doesn't satisfy anyone, honestly. And we're also going to talk to Brad Young, Hairstyle Fisher & Young. He's a chief legal analyst here for the radio station, friend of mine, someone I absolutely adore. When it comes to legal issues, he's so good at breaking it down in common language. So we're going to talk to him about the AutoPen hearing. And I also want to talk to him about the end of copyright, because there's been a lot of, especially Josh Hawley, testimony where he's been questioning people about Meta's practices when it comes to artificial intelligence. And part of questioning how they use it is where they get their information from when they are training their models. And is that legal? Are they breaking copyright issues? And then I was watching some of these different videos. It's so fascinating how Josh Hawley breaks it down. Let's look at the internal messaging of what was going on at Meta. And as we go through this messaging, we realize very quickly that even they knew they were working in some really murky water. So I'm looking forward to talking to Brad Young about that too. And I mean, that's just on top of the huge show that we have in so many different clips. And I think at the end of this hour, maybe, or the start of next hour, I want to look at some of Shane Gillis's SB monologue from last night. I don't know if you, I didn't even know, honestly, that the ESPYs were going on. It's so off my radar. I don't even care about ESPN. But all of a sudden I see all the videos start circulating on YouTube this morning. I'm like, okay, I'm going to watch that. He did not disappoint when it came to the controversy. So we're going to look at that too. I got so much to get to. If you want to find me online, Ryan Recker, at Ryan Recker on Twitter, Ryan Recker Radio on Facebook. Don't go anywhere. You're listening to the Mark Reardon Show. I'm Ryan Recker filling in 97.1 FM Talk. And I'm Ryan Recker filling in for Mark Reardon. Joining us now is the Senior Director of Government Affairs for the National Taxpayers Union, Thomas Aiello. Thank you for joining us in St. Louis. We appreciate it.
Hey, good afternoon. Thanks for having me.
So we get $9 billion clawback in the first rescission. Okay, I guess that's something. So where do you think we stand? Do you think that's enough, or do you think we should be doing more when it comes to fiscal responsibility with taxpayer money?
Yeah, let's just set the groundwork. What the Senate did yesterday was actually historic. They haven't passed a rescissions bill in 50 years. We're awaiting floor action on the House, which I think is going to take place tomorrow. They're just working out some attendance issues. But, you know, we're expecting it to pass on a party line basis. So hopefully it'll be at the president's desk tomorrow evening before the deadline, because they have until tomorrow to pass it and for the president to sign it. Otherwise, it just goes away. But yeah, it, like you said, $9 billion is a step in the right direction. It's not going to solve our budget crisis that we're dealing with. We're running $2 trillion deficits each year. It is a very, very small drop in the bucket. But you know, you start addressing a problem by saying you have a problem. So hopefully this is the first of many steps to get in the right, to get this problem solved.
So what you're saying is we need congressional intervention where they are coaxed into a room. Basically, we're not going to tell them what they're there for. And then we surprise them with, we need to have a talk about your finances.
Yeah, look, I mean, we've added $381 billion to the national debt since the House passed this bill on June 12th. That's 40 days ago. I mean, we really have a real problem in this country where we're spending $11 billion a day just on our debt. We're adding $11 billion a day on our debt. So, look, I'm happy we're actually having the conversation about clawing back money, but you know, we shouldn't oversell this to the people that this is somehow a silver bullet to the budget problems we're facing.
Okay, so what if they just keep finding more things to add to different future packages for rescission? So let's say this is a first step and they find out that it works. They find it may be the path of least resistance. So they'll say, okay, what's next? Let's go down the list of what Elon Musk put out for us and we'll just keep working down it. Is that something that you would look at as positive? Or do you think that maybe the next step is to take this momentum into something more long-term when it comes to budget talks?
Yeah, 100%. So we've known for quite a while now that the administration only sent one package as a trial balloon to see if the House and Senate were serious about clawing back some of the DOGE cuts. So we're going to pass it. That's great. I'm expecting the White House to send a few more packages over to the House and Senate in September, because remember, they're out for August recess. So in September, we're expecting a few packages that will hopefully claw back billions more dollars. But that's one part about how we address the situation that we're in. So rescissions, clawing back the money is one. We also need to get our structural budgets in order. Right now, Congress is going through that process. Now, the Speaker and the President have said we want to spend less on discretionary spending. That's things for like the military and all the other departments like Energy and Health and Human Services. We want to spend less next year than we did this year. Again, that's great. And when you take that into account with economic growth through deregulation and the president's tax cuts, I think we'll be able to not only create jobs and grow wages, but generate more tax revenue through the process. So when you take all of those things together, I think that's how we actually start to get our fiscal house in order.
I know you couldn't see this because, you know, I was on video, but when you said Congress is out in August, I gave you the biggest eye roll. I thought, oh, of course they're not going to work. So what do you do at the National Taxpayers Union? What do you advocate for?
Yeah, we advocate for an efficient government, making sure your tax dollars are spent effectively. Unfortunately, that's not always the case. As we know, we advocate for free markets and lower taxes. So a lot of our attention this year has obviously been focused on extending President Trump's tax cuts that were to expire at the end of the year. So, you know, when you take that into account, we avoided a $4.5 trillion tax increase, and we achieved a number of pro-growth tax reductions across the board, and we're keeping more money in taxpayers' pockets. So now that that tax increase is off the table, hopefully, and this is what we're advocating to Congress right now, is we pass the bill, we need to get serious about fixing our government and how much money we spend. So right now, the attention is focused on the government spending side of things. Like I said, right now, Congress is focused on allocating money for fiscal year 2026. And we're urging them to not only spend less than last year, but, you know, pass a fiscal commission that can address, look into the core drivers of our debt and offer solutions on how do we fix it, and then maybe even a return to pre-COVID spending levels. That alone on discretionary spending would save $400 billion a year, right? It's about 25% of our annual deficits, so it's not enough to solve the problem, but again, it's a real solution to address the real driver of our debt.
Yeah, here's part of the problem that you find. I live in Michigan, so I'm able to do a lot of these shows, but I lived in St. Louis for a long time. And you find that when you talk about pre-COVID dollars versus where state budgets are today, they have factored in so much bloat from government that they put it into their budgets. So all these different states have budgets that have just ballooned to the point where they're ready to explode. So the idea of cutting back federal money scares the states because they are basically spending money they didn't have to begin with in areas they didn't need to spend it to begin with. They only spent it because they were given it and told they had to spend it. So now they are deathly afraid that they're going to have to cut back themselves, just like the federal government is doing. So how does the feds go out there and cut spending without all these states collapsing and all these different people in the states saying, you know, our kids are going to be out on the street starving to death because of what Donald Trump's doing?
Sure. Well, first of all, we shouldn't believe the scare tactics that the other side is going to throw out there. And I like to say 2019 was a great year, right? We had record job creation. The stock market was at record highs and we had virtually no inflation. For all intents and purposes, it was great. And we spent about $2 trillion less that year than we're spending now. So I think if the other side were to do scare tactics and say the world is going to collapse, there'll be a fiscal calamity, I say if we return to those levels, we actually help avoid a debt problem that will cause a fiscal calamity. If we cannot pay our bills, that is going to lead to economic shocks across the board, and states are going to be in a much worse position then than they would be now if they began to cut. And I think sometimes we do need a little bit of shock therapy, especially at the state level, where you have these states that are so reliant on the federal government to balance their budgets that if some of that revenue or that funding were to go away, they would be in the red, and that's a real problem. And ultimately, what we need to see is just a return to fiscal sanity, because the alternative could be so much worse than if Congress were to turn off the spigot of largesse that flows their way.
Yep. Thomas Aiello joining us here, Senior Director of Government Affairs for the National Taxpayers Union. And I think if you look at the problems that people face on a day-to-day basis, you can say, okay, how much more is the government spending? And are there still potholes in the streets? So what are they spending it on? That's the question. Are the schools still in poor conditions? Are the test scores still towards the bottom of the barrel nationwide? What are they spending this on? If they're taking the excess, all this extra money, it's going somewhere. Someone's the beneficiary of that. It's all of these things that weren't necessary to begin with. They were only spending it for the sake of spending it. They didn't put it in areas where they really needed it. And for a lot of ways, it's the state's own faults for being so mismanaged, especially the blue states for being so mismanaged. They're out there now with their hairs on fire. So I would think that when we look at the budget and the way that is going, we can't achieve this sort of thing. The thing I'm afraid of is that this $9 billion rescission is just, they're throwing us a bone and that's going to be the end of it. Like, they're not going to go further down the road. Do you have any fear of that?
Absolutely. I mean, the margins in the House are incredibly tight, and we really only have a 6-seat majority in the Senate. So politics matter in all of this. So that's absolutely a fear. What I do take comfort in is obviously the steps that are being taken by President Trump and the administration to not only reduce the federal workforce, which they can do without Congress, and you can save money that way, but also, as I mentioned, this appropriations process they're doing now. The leadership of Congress and the House and the president have said, we're going to spend less money than we did last year on discretionary spending. That is really where we will see the savings. And it's great that we're finding some savings here and there through DOGE cuts. But at the end of the day, we need to get our fiscal house in order through the regular appropriations process. And it's what really scares me is we are at our highest debt levels as a percentage of GDP since 1946. Right now, we are fighting no wars. The economy is generally pretty good. So if we were to have some sort of event like another COVID, a war, or, you know, an unforeseen economic issue, what will happen to our ability to pay our bills? And that's really what scares me. I think there is a recognition on many in the House, particularly from the Freedom Caucus and others, that we need to fix the house when the sun is shining, because there is a storm brewing just off the horizon. And if we don't fix our roof, we are going to be flooded with what will come through a debt crisis. So I'm hopeful that we'll be able to get that. We just need the Democratic Party to play ball through that process, but I don't necessarily think they will. So we need to find a plan B in how we address it all.
All right. Thomas Aiello, Senior Director of Government Affairs for the National Taxpayers Union. If people wanted to look you up, where can they go?
Yeah, they can go to our website, ntu.org, or they can follow us on social media, Facebook, X, and LinkedIn.
ntu.org. Thomas Aiello, thank you so much for coming on today here in St. Louis. Our Chief Legal Analyst, Brad Young, joining us after the break. We're going to talk some legal issues, including witnesses taking the Fifth. We'll talk about that again because it's back in the news. But the Otto Penn hearing is very interesting in all of this and how it plays into it. So I'm Ryan Recker filling in for Mark Reardon. Don't go anywhere. 97.1 FM Talk. And I'm Ryan Recker filling in for Mark Reardon. Joining us now is our Chief Legal Analyst and partner with Harris Tal Fisher & Young, Brad Young. How are you, sir?
Ryan, I'm doing great, my friend. Blessed to talk to you.
I know. We had you on twice last week when I was filling in. Now, once this week. They must be really paying you overtime for this.
Oh, you have no idea, my friend. No idea.
Well, I saw this story, and this is in the last couple of days. There's a trial going on in Florida regarding Teslas, and it's a jury trial, which is interesting, too. So the idea is a person a couple of years ago were using Tesla's autopilot function. And I think they drove into a parked car. Someone ended up dying. So there's a trial now going on about it. So there's a lot of newfangled technological advances that I think a lot of people are unfamiliar with. And do cases like this test the law when there's something that hasn't happened before comes up in front of a judge?
Well, Ryan, this doesn't just test the law. It really shatters it. And let me go through some of the reasons. That's why I find this so fascinating. Legally speaking, obviously somebody died, and that's terrible. But from a legal perspective, it's fascinating. So let me break some of this down for you. During in a traditional negligence tort action, the jury has to find someone was negligent, and negligence is determined by what every person who's ever gone to law school knows is called the reasonable person standard. What would a reasonable person do in the same or similar circumstances? Well, in this case, there is no person. Okay. We've got a computer. So you can't say what would a reasonable self-driving vehicle do in a situation like this, because it doesn't make any sense. Also, when you talk about this idea of negligence, that means that somebody had a duty and they failed that duty. But does that apply to a computer driving a car? I mean, what you might have some sort of, was it negligent programming? I don't know that that's even a thing. All right. You is it the software? Is it the hardware? Is it a sensor? Is it the owner operator? I mean, it blows up and shatters all of our ideas of holding a person negligent because there's no person involved except for the driver. And that really factors into this case as well.
So it's the main defense from Tesla in a case like this, essentially the driver is responsible for all of the car's actions, even if it's in autopilot mode?
Well, yeah, because, and this is where it was very important for Tesla and other car makers who have auto driving features to make sure that the lawyers get involved. Because one of the requirements is, and we've all seen it, if you've seen someone driving down the road, is that you have to remain awake and alert and essentially with your hands inches from the wheel at all times. Why do those attorneys for the car companies do that? This case demonstrates it. Because in this case in Florida, the person who was behind the wheel, I won't say driving, the driver, but the person behind the wheel dropped his cell phone in the floor of his car. He was down, had his head down in the floorboard searching for his cell phone when the Tesla blew a red light and hit a pedestrian and killed them. And so Tesla's position is there was no auto driving feature even at play here because the person was supposed to be there. They were by definition negligent because they weren't following our terms of service when it comes to how to operate the vehicle when it's in self-driving mode. So that's their entire defense.
Yeah, so I might have been thinking about a different case there. This is absolutely terrible. And all things considered, what happens when, let's say, state law plays a factor? Like if I was Tesla, I'd be thinking to myself, well, if they're not following state law and what is necessary for you to be on the road, then take it up with the state of Florida. Don't take it up with us because they're the ones that supersede the things that we put into place. I would almost think I would rely on the state law to protect me in a case like that.
Well, the only state law that applies even in Florida is a state law dealing with people driving vehicles and negligence. And so the argument by Tesla is that the person behind the wheel, I keep wanting to call him driver, but he's not, the person behind the wheel was negligent because he was searching for his cell phone instead of being ready to operate the vehicle. So that's the only laws that really apply in this situation because Florida doesn't have any specific laws about self-driving vehicles. But then it gets even to a bigger issue. If you're suing for negligence against Tesla, isn't that really a product liability case? I mean, it's not really negligence. It's a product liability that the car malfunctioned. But then you have to present evidence that the car did malfunction, that there was a problem with the code, the source code, or the sensors, or it just becomes extremely complex, more complex than really any personal injury lawsuit. And that's why I said at the beginning, it really shatters our idea of suing for vehicular injuries when there's a self-driving car involved.
Well, speaking of a new frontier, artificial intelligence, I saw some hearings and Josh Hawley was a big part of the clips that were curated online. The idea that you have companies like Meta who are scraping data pools of information, works that are, I'm guessing, under copyright protection for their training of their artificial intelligent computers. And you have these large companies that are relying on other people's intellectual property and using that in order to benefit from that. Now, we don't exactly know how some of these different models work or how these AI computers think or how much of anything was taken from anything. It's just there's some of it that's kind of a mystery. But someone made the argument that if we're going to allow these AI bots and computers to scrape and take whatever they want, does that end copyright? Because if you can't be protected because of what these AI bots are doing, that could be the end of copyright law.
Well, I don't think it ends copyright law, but again, it stretches it maybe beyond what it was intended to do. Look, there's three main issues when it comes to AI and copyright. The first one is if an AI writes a novel, can that be copyrighted? The answer is no. That's already been decided. There was a great case, Ryan. You're going to love this. There was a great case where a monkey took a picture. And the monkey had the camera, and the monkey took the picture. And the owner of the monkey tried to copyright it and sell it. And he couldn't do it because he wasn't the photographer. And the Copyright Act says it has to be with human authorship. So the monkey took the picture. So it couldn't be copyrighted. It was in the public domain. So if a chatbot writes a novel, it's in the public domain. It can't be copyrighted. That's number one. Number two is the AI training, as you mentioned, where it scrapes and learns the English language. But most of the time, those AI don't reproduce the novel. So you don't really have a copyright violation unless it's reproduced somewhere. So then the third issue is the reproduction of copyrighted work. So, for example, if you go on ChatGPT and you say, give me a detailed summary of the novel, The Hunt for Red October, and then it gives you all the detailed summary, that's a copyright violation. But simply scraping the novel, I don't believe is a copyright violation if you're just teaching the AI how to learn and use the English language. It's the reproduction of that copyrighted work that becomes a violation.
I see the videos happen sometimes, the articles written where lawyers try to introduce AI video to put like their opening statement together. Have you seen any of those?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And the judges go berserk, right? Because they're like, I want no part of this. We don't want some floating head Max Headroom giving testimony. You remember old Max Headroom? That might be a little before your time. But they don't want Max Headroom presenting evidence at a trial, and they just throw it out because there is no procedure for allowing an AI avatar to be a witness at a trial.
Right. Well, in case even representing a person, I think someone was trying to represent themselves through ChatGPT, and they would take the text from ChatGPT and run it through a video generator as if some human lawyer was presenting it for him. It wasn't even coming from a real lawyer. It was just the artificial intelligence summary of what he thinks a lawyer should be doing or what they think. One last question about this auto pen hearing, all the witnesses pleading the fifth so far. What happens in instances like this? So I know we talked about this a little bit last week, but the whole idea of trying to get to the bottom of this, it sounds like this oversight committee is going to get no answers from anyone. So pleading the fifth, correct, what happens in instances like this?
Well, for all witnesses except for Biden's doctor, okay, I want to exclude Biden's doctor for a moment. For all other witnesses, if they plead the fifth, the committee has to extend them a grant of immunity that states that they can't be prosecuted for anything that they say. Once that happens, they call the witnesses back, and if they still refuse to testify, they can be locked up for essentially impeding the work of Congress. It becomes a violation of a judicial order on a congressional subpoena. Now, that doesn't apply to the doctor, because the doctor also has doctor-patient privilege that he can fall behind and say, I'm not going to answer, even if you give me a grant of immunity, because it violates the doctor-patient privilege. But for all other witnesses, they can be compelled to testify. And if they don't testify, they're looking at jail time.
All right. There's this moment in Breaking Bad where where you have the two main characters out in the desert, and they are about to end the life of this person who's a lawyer. And he says, hold on. Do you have a dollar? Take a dollar and put it in my pocket.
Yep.
Puts it in. And Saul Goodman says, okay, now I can represent you. So anything that happens is privileged, and nothing could force me to say anything you tell me. I can represent you. So it's a very big point in the show. Is that how it works? If like, let's say a lawyer says, okay, under duress, put a dollar in my pocket. Now we have the confidentiality. Now the government can't force me to tell your secrets.
That's true. I will tell you, I've never had the experience of standing in the desert at the point of a gun and taking a dollar bill from someone who was nefarious. I've never personally had that experience, but I can tell you conceptually, yes. The attorney-client privilege cannot be busted up unless, and here's where it falls down in that Breaking Bad, unless the attorney knows of future criminal conduct. And then an attorney has an obligation to break attorney-client privilege if the attorney knows or is made aware of future criminal activity.
Oh, well, this kind of blows the storylines apart in that show. What about the instances, the spousal privilege? So let's say Jill Biden, Joe Biden. Could the same privileges for a spouse be extended, kind of like a doctor?
Yeah, but it's interesting. It doesn't flow both ways, so to speak. So what happens is this. If spouse A says, I'm not going to testify against spouse B and I'm exerting my spousal privilege, that stands. But if spouse B says, I want to squeal on spouse A, they can't block that testimony. You follow me?
It
really only flows one way.
Can Jill Biden say I'm a doctor of education, so I'm I don't have to double privilege?
Yes, because if we quote Whoopi Goldberg from The View when she was talking about Jill Biden, she says, "Oh, Dr. Jill Biden, she's a wonderful physician." That's a quote from Whoopi Goldberg. But I don't know that there's any academic privilege here just because you happen to have a PhD in education. I don't think that exists.
You know, double privilege is a good name for a book, I think. I'm going to have to write that down. Or some sort of a storyline for a show. All right, Brad Young, Harris Dowell Fisher and Young, Chief Legal Analyst here on the radio station. Thank you so much for joining us and breaking this down for us.
My pleasure, Ryan. Anytime, buddy.
And I'm Ryan Recker, filling in for Mark Reardon. Don't go anywhere. 97.1 FM Talk. Welcome back to the Mark Reardon Show. I'm Ryan Recker filling in. I always love conversations with Brad Young because I can ask him anything that is not serious, but he'll have a serious answer for it. And he still allows me to ask him questions after all the dumb ones I've come up with. Ethan, back in the studio, you know, we were talking a little bit after that segment and during the break about Shane Gillis last night was hosting the ESPYs. Number one, I had no idea the ESPYs were going on. Did you know that it was happening last night?
Not until I started seeing the clips on Twitter. I didn't know until I started seeing that people were just absolutely losing their mind at what Shane Gillis was saying on Twitter.
Well, that's how I found out about it this morning. All of a sudden, it's Shane Gillis galore on people posting clips on YouTube and Twitter and all these other places. And I thought, okay, I want to play some of these, but then you started naming some of the clips that we've been pulling, and I thought, I don't know, are we allowed to play this? Like, Drew is pulling some of the racier ones in the back. Drew's thinking, how can I get these people fired by playing Shane Gillis jokes from the ESPYs last night? He's like, okay, if this one doesn't get him fired, we're definitely going to go to the next one, and then we'll definitely, for sure, after
here,
the third, you'll be gone.
I got a couple pulled up here on Twitter I think we could play. Here's one last night on Shea Gilgis Alexander foul baiting.
Okay.
Well, give me one second to see if it'll actually play. Our audio's is having some issues now.
No, sometimes trying to get it from a computer source to the right spot. We can always do this in the next hour, too. But the idea that Shane Gillis went in there and he thought, I'm going to be as controversial as possible, which is Shane Gillis being Shane Gillis. He's hilarious, though, by the way. I know, Ethan, you're a big fan of his.
He
is like the top of the game. Is there a bigger comedian right now? It's like him and the other guy that's the Christian that I like.
Nate Bargatze?
Nate Bargatze. Those two are like the top two comedians in the country right now.
Yeah, they're both huge. They're both doing really well. Bargatze tends to be a little bit cleaner. But, I mean, Shane Gillis, it's just refreshing to, you know, I think there was a stretch right where even comedians were kind of being pressed to have to be politically correct, and I'm like, it's not really funny if it's politically correct. It can be, right? But it's so much more fun, right? And you get this from the crowd last night where you're kind of like, oh man, should I be able to laugh? That's how you know it's good, right? When it's to the point where people are uncomfortable hearing it. That's how you know it's good quality humor.
He did have a throwback to Norm MacDonald's time hosting the ESPYs. And the notorious Norm MacDonald, one of his biggest jokes ever made. Do you remember that one from Norm back when he hosted?
Okay, I have it working now. Hold on. I have it actually working. Here we go.
There's one thing I want to say before I get out of here, and this is a dumb joke. You guys aren't going to like it, but it was it's just a Norm MacDonald joke that I loved when he hosted the ESPYs, and I'm going to do it now. Travis Hunter won the Heisman Trophy this year. He's the first defensive player since Charles Woodson to win the Heisman. Congratulations, Travis Hunter, winning the Heisman. That's something they can never take away from you unless you kill your wife and a waiter, in which case they can take that away from you. Well, see, a lot of you don't like me, and that's okay.
Well, that was keep in mind right off of OJ and the trial and all these other things with him. And Norm MacDonald does that joke, and these athletes are like, oh, I can't laugh at that. And some were, and some were like, oh, can't do that. Ken Griffey Jr. did the, no thanks, can't laugh. But Norm MacDonald was the best at jokes like that. He was so good. All right, let's play some clips after we get back in the 5 o'clock, right after the news there. How about we do it there? Because I don't want to get fired. I mean, I don't think you do either, some of these other ones. The Caitlin Clark jokes.
Here's the Shea Gildas Alexander one.
SGA is here. Give it up for SGA. Hell yeah, bro. And now everybody sitting around him is in foul trouble.
All right, you have to explain that to me. It's funny, but I don't know why.
So Shea Gildas Alexander won the MVP. He was the NBA MVP this past year, but people get so mad at him because he really emphasizes drawing the fouls. Like, you know how LeBron really plays, kind of people get on him for playing soft and he kind of flops everywhere.
Oh yeah.
Shea Gildas Alexander, who they call SGA, is by far the most dramatic player in the NBA as far as any time there's any sort of touch or anything. He's just flopping everywhere, but he gets these calls. And so that's why the joke was, is that he was, everyone around him all of a sudden just sitting in the crowd was in foul trouble.
You know, LeBron, it's just comical, the stuff he complains about. But NBA, people watch that and they see this flopping. And one, they think this is like soccer. Two, they think, I'm so glad they don't do this garbage in hockey. Could you imagine? Like, I'm sure there are some players that acted like this, but hockey players are generally, they don't put up with this kind of stuff. If you're out there flopping around and acting like SGA or LeBron or whatever it is, they'll give you real something to cry about. Like, they'll put you through the glass. Mm-hmm. They'll put you over the board into the opposition's right there on the bench. All right, well, do you think it was a success? Do you think it's a good thing that the ESPYs brought him in to be controversial, say these type of jokes? Is this mission accomplished for them, getting the attention they need?
Absolutely, right? I mean, the heat that Disney and ESPN have gotten is that they are, right, like they are not centered, right, as far as a lot of their stuff goes. So I feel like this is really good for them to bring in someone that was, I don't know, it kind of, I feel even if, you know, the crowd wasn't sure how to take it, I feel like it pushes them back a little bit more towards the center of the aisle. I don't know if that would say they're completely in the center now, but it definitely, you know, I say kudos to ESPN for being willing to, you know, not make it an entire story about politics and actually have it just be a night where you could just laugh. So I thought it was very well done.
I got to say, when it comes to sports, football, whatever it may be, they're trying their best to get as many female people to watch their events, their games. And if you go back the last couple of years, it's paying so much attention to Taylor Swift. Oh, look, Taylor Swift, her boyfriend plays for the Kansas City Chiefs. And they do everything they can to appeal to the female viewer because they got the guys wrapped up. So I thought, okay, ESPN, if they're going to stay in that sort of lane, then a Shane Gillis will not appeal to them. So they're not going to get the demographic they're trying to build on. But then they throw it and they say, here's one for the boys. And we're going to let you have it on the ESPYs. All right, you might have to play some more clips, or maybe this will come up at some point else in the show. I'm Ryan Recker, filling in for Mark Reardon. Don't go anywhere. 97.1 FM Talk.
Get more at 97.1talk.com.